The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2016 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2016. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at accsedu.org.
My name is Tiffany Blake. I teach at Covenant Academy in Cypress, Texas. I have been there for 6 years as a teacher, and before that, I was there a couple of years as a parent first before joining staff. And I'm excited to be here to talk to you about something that I love. I typically get geeky. If you were to send a child into a candy store, you could send me into a math manipulative store, and I just get all giddy. That's kind of a little bit of who I am. But before I get any further and begin, would you pray with me, please? Gracious Father, we thank you for the opportunity to steward the creatures that you have given us within our classroom, to steward the creation of the subject matter that you have given us, and Father, to just be overjoyed in the calling that you have given us as teachers. We thank you for this time to gather and to contemplate mathematics. For it's in your Son's name we pray. Amen. As I said, I am a teacher at Covenant Academy, but what I left out is I am actually no longer a grammar school teacher. I have been in the upper school for the last 4 years. I am a math teacher at heart, but most of my bulk training and teaching experience over the last 20 years does come within the primary settings. So being a math person, I was plucked and moved up into the upper school when the need arose, and I have enjoyed it ever since, but I have not fully left my roots, if you will. One of the things that I want to just kind of say up front is that is part of making sense of Singapore math is for you to understand that my making sense of this is to hopefully build a bridge. One of the things that I have observed is that the math in focus, the Singapore math, the math in vision, all of these bar modeling techniques that are introduced within print, within the current stage of our curriculum options that are out there, they're focused on the process. And they're focused on the process because it's getting at the why and the how behind it. And I want to real quick just allow me this small short rabbit trail to understand why the why and the how is important. One of the things that we have to contemplate is the why and the how is how we had great scientists and great mathematicians who came up with contemplation of Pythagorean theorem, contemplation of quantum mechanics. These were great scientists and great philosophers and mathematicians that went about contemplating, having conversations, exploring. And one of the things that we have to be careful of in modern mathematics is that we don't leave that out. One of our big battles is against technology. I get students in seventh grade teaching them pre-algebra, and they are, all right, getting into the calculators. Let's go get one of those big fancy graphing calculators, and I don't allow them. And the reason why is because you are not allowed in our classrooms to use a calculator until you understand how it is creating that answer for you or why it is getting that answer to even begin with. And I give a foundational story at the beginning of the year. It's an introduction to a book called The Universe in Zero Words, and it's an opportunity for students to understand why I insist on the why and how before they're allowed to just compute and calculate. In that introduction, there is a little story called The Abacus versus the Algorist. And it's a story about Richard Feynman, who was a physicist and Nobel Prize winner. And he is in Rio de Janeiro, and it's kind of low-key afternoon in a restaurant, and an abacus salesman walks in. And the wait staff kind of engage in conversation with these two visitors, and they then encounter this opportunity for kind of a contest, if you will, who can calculate the answers to big problems fastest. And early on, the abacus salesman is winning and doing quite well. But as the problems become more complicated and more complex, the time of advanced answering narrows. And the algorist, the person who has contemplation, who is able to visualize what goes into the solving of these more complex problems, is able to narrow that time. Not because it's a race, but because he is able to understand what's going on. And so finally, the abacus salesman says, "Cube roots. Give us a number to find the cube root for, and I can still beat him." Waiter throws out this number, 1,729.03, and they begin to work. And through the process of working, they get the first number, a second number, 12 point, and Mr. Feynman is quietly sitting, starting to write numbers and calculating, and he's processing. There's obviously a process that's going on, and what the abacus salesman doesn't realize is he is being able to fall back onto prior knowledge, the hows, the whys of what constitutes a value. And in the end, it is shared that the reason he was able to win this final challenge is because one of the cube roots that is so innately embedded within physics is something that he was able to start with because he understood a context and could give it a reason. So one of the things that I want to encourage you is that within the mathematics, as much as we want them to know their math facts, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit today because I feel it's part of building that bridge to understanding the bar modeling methods that are embedded within Singapore math, understanding why we do that and how we do that, and I also want to introduce critically when we do that as well. We want our students to ultimately graduate. Ultimately, they are going to either pursue a career in an arts, they're going to pursue a career where they're going to use their hands in one of the common arts, as I saw referred to this morning at the science session. And then I also know that we're going to have some graduates that are going to go into teaching, business, engineering, whatever their field. We want a strong foundation, and that foundation begins in kindergarten. So with building a strong mathematics foundation, we want to first recognize and understand that, yes, there is a language involved in math, and I want to kind of share what I've developed a little bit on how that language develops and how it parallels to what a parent may be more receptive to seeing and understanding and not right away, because myself as a parent did not necessarily learn this new math or this new way of doing things. And I'm sure you, along the way, one of the challenges that you are overcoming is parent support in this new thinking, which is not new. It is encouraging thinking, hence the key word. So language becomes the foundation, and making sure we're laying a strong foundation of the use of the language. Also, you have this idea of number sense. First, we're building a language so that we can understand and create a number sense. That is so that we can begin to have a conversation about the language. Before you can actually create a math sentence, you have to understand what each of those pieces represent and mean before you can converse with, even then, again, a word problem that introduces this idea of critical thinking. Because as soon as you layer things onto it and you go beyond just a number, just beyond the context of the conversation, then you have to then ask a student to analyze what's being presented. So much like when you're builders or building a foundation, you want to make sure that you're using the right materials to ensure it's solid. It's a solid, sure foundation. You want your house not built on the sand, but on the rock. The more you want it to be structurally solid, the deeper you pour it. For example, a building can support with a certain amount of foundation a one-story building. But as soon as you want to go to a second level or a two-story, the foundation requirements change. Well, you want to build kind of like at the bottom this idea that what you start in kindergarten is building a foundation not just for first grade, but it's actually building a foundation that's going to continue to just roll and grow and develop for that ultimate graduate. One of the things that I have kind of shared with our staff, part of what I do is also encourage and come alongside and partner with, if you will, our grammar school teachers when they are facing some challenges. And one of the things that I did and developed a couple of years ago is lots of times grammar school teachers are very comfortable and just ready to dive into literature, the humanities. But sometimes math, because either it's not natural, because it is different than how you and I learned it growing up, it becomes something that's scary all of a sudden, in the same way it could be for a parent who also has a different connection. So I developed this little kind of parallel chart. I'm going to kind of take us through it somewhat quickly, but it's kind of paralleling the development of the language for both English and mathematics. To begin with, when a child is learning the language, we might teach them our ABCs. We recognize that you have a name for a letter that goes with this picture, the shape that's being shown. And then we all of a sudden assign that this A has a phonogram connection. It makes an A sound. Likewise, these phonograms are then built and put together to create words. You see they're building blocks. The letters become building blocks for phonograms. Phonograms become building blocks for our words. So where we may begin with something abstract, like the letter A, in the end, we give it meaning. We give it purpose. And so when we first look at this, a child might first see a C, an A, a T, but then developmentally they're going to learn that first letter can make a k sound, or the second letter could make an a sound, the third letter could make a t sound. But when we put those all together, we get the word cat, and all of a sudden it has meaning. Mathematics and the language of math is very similar. We begin with symbols. We have these digits. Not numbers, but digits. These digits 0 through 9. And they're rather abstract in the beginning. They're just this picture that represents something that we want them to learn what it represents. These individual digits then are learned to be numbers. We can count out 3. I have 3 blocks. 1, 2, 3. We give it a value when we also put it in relationship to other numbers. Based on its placement, based on its order, it then takes on a new meaning. So when I first look at these two images, I see a 1 and I see a 2. But based on its placement and where it is next to each other, it becomes the number 12 and has meaning and value based on where the 1 is and where the 2 is. So, I could ask you, can you find for me 12 red blocks in that picture? All of a sudden, that question has context and meaning because a language has been developed. Well, continuing on, these words we teach them also can be put together to make sentences. And then all of a sudden we introduce these other abstract ideas of symbols, commas, periods, question marks. And then we take and we build upon that, and these sentences are developed into paragraphs to communicate larger ideas and larger meanings, building on information of a topic. But again, these new ideas, these abstract symbols are introduced at some point. In mathematics, we create number sentences using additional symbols. Plus, minus, multiplication, parentheses, equals, exponents. All of a sudden, the size of the number also begins to matter. Its placement, it's not just where it falls, but the size of it kind of has a new context as well. And then these number sentences can then be utilized within the context of a word problem. Again, it's understanding the order of the language, understanding the communication of what's being asked to, again, learn more information or gain more information about what's being communicated in the topic at hand. So again, you have new abstract symbols that are being added to this idea of developing a language. So within mathematics, many of you may be familiar with the concept of something being concrete, and then we develop the pictorial process, and then we end with this idea of this abstract thought. So just like the physicist is able to take these abstract ideas, he's relying on concrete information he already knows, applying it and picturing the process as he is analyzing to ultimately get that answer to a very complex problem. Well, at the concrete level, we're talking about our hands-on math. Your kindergarten, first graders, and second graders, whatever level it is that you are introducing some sort of hands-on manipulative. It's object-oriented. It's manipulative-based, and it's also kind of rooted in a counting mentality. So from a math facts perspective, when we're first teaching our math facts, we don't all of a sudden jump to, well, 2 plus 3 is 5. Why? Because it's something you need to memorize. We give them a context. We give them a base. They understand that 2 is 2 of these, and we understand that 3 is 3 of these, and when we put them all together, we get 5, something that can concretely be seen and understood. And we see pictures, count the number of butterflies on the branch, you know, so forth and so forth. It's something that is tangible, whether it be in their hands or whether it be on an image that we can kind of count it out. We can visualize it. Even if we can't put our hands on the block, I can visualize having 5 butterflies lined up on my finger. Well, that next phase of the idea is this pictorial idea. And it's not so much the picture of the butterflies on the finger as it is creating an image for something that doesn't necessarily exist for us to look at. That's where this bar modeling comes into play. And I want to throw in just kind of real quickly that in our math facts at our school, we use, it's published by Otter Creek, and it's the rocket math. And one of the things that it is, there's a research paper that's associated that they have published that it looks at this idea of counting and then deriving, and then it becomes automatic. It's automaticity. And one of the things that the pictorial can kind of, if you're thinking about this, it's image building. Even if we don't put it paper to pencil, it is image building. So this pictorial idea is creating a conversation about numbers. It's the conversational number sense. If I am trying to understand something without having something concrete, what can I create to build a conversation around what is being looked for? It's a visual transition, whether it's that paper to pencil or it's a mental image that is created using a chart, a bar model, a diagram. All of these things are ways that we are trying to relate something that is concrete ultimately to something that will become abstract. So this idea of building number sense is where we begin to have a discussion about the information. This level of learning, whether it be about a math fact or whether it be about something in algebra, it becomes a bridge that models the concrete to the abstract, and it's important in developing that critical thinker. One of the things that is sometimes observed is that many of the resources that I mentioned a moment ago that are in print and available is often that idea of the bar model is not introduced until third grade, maybe late second grade is kind of an introduction to it. And I'd like to kind of propose that that bar model should actually come sooner. Because if you don't have this idea of an abstract image, because the first time you introduce something, it's going to be abstract until they have a context for it, then if the first time they see a bar model is not until third grade or late second grade, sometimes that's going to be too late. They've already learned what 2 plus 3 equals. Why am I now having to create a bar to show what it means when I already know what it means? For that, that builds a frustration, and I've heard some of our grammar school teachers share that frustration. They already know how to do this. What does the bar mean? Well, that's one of the things that I've worked with our teachers on last year. I introduced this idea of using bar modeling within the context of our math facts to help build that bridge to when the bar modeling that is being introduced within Singapore math or the bar modeling method, whichever resource that you might be utilizing at your school, it's an opportunity to kind of build the bridge sooner so that when the bar model is introduced, it's not abstract in and of itself. So here's the idea. If you think of these lovely Unifix cubes that often are in a bucket, multicolored, and all grabbed out, and we just grab whatever colors that we want to build on, and we instead think of them in the way that the Cuisinart rods are developed. So the Cuisinart rods, how many of you have Cuisinart rods in your school? How many of you who have them use them? good. So one of the things that I developed was I worked backwards from this idea of a bar model. A bar model is a pictorial box. It's a bar. Okay? Think about a bar graph. You have something that represents a bar. Cuisinart rods are bars. Well, if you work backwards from there, they have these lovely little small linking cubes. They're called centimeter gram cubes, or sometimes they're referred to as just a gram cube. They're teeny tiny, and for a second and third grader, they have the fine motor skills to be able to deal with these, and you can build these to be the same length as a Cuisinart rod. But before that, you have these linking cubes that can also, matching the Cuisinart rod colors, develop this idea of a bar representing. So kindergartners are teaching, learning how to, when you're teaching, they're learning how this idea of different concepts and objects are representing numbers, and how when you put them together, they represent bigger numbers, especially when you introduce this idea, the abstract plus symbol or the equal symbol. What we're doing is we're getting to an opportunity with using the bar sooner so it doesn't become abstract in third grade. So this abstract, then, if the bar, and I'm going to come back to that bar modeling stuff in just a moment, I promise. If the abstract is the bar itself, then we lose the opportunity to really learn how to analyze the data, to develop the critical thinking, to utilize the mental math that is being developed along the way, and then create the person who is comfortable with calculating. Remember, not the calculator, but comfortable with calculating. So the idea that the math facts become the foundation, and if those are also rooted in representations as well, then it's not an abstract idea when you get there. So let me kind of give you an idea of what I mean by some of that. In kindergarten, a number is abstract, but they recognize that five is five of those. But a first grader is going to have a context for understanding that its placement of five could mean five hundreds, depending on where it falls within a set of numbers. A second grader is going to understand, well, when you put a bar in between, there's the context of a numerator and a denominator, so a two on top is going to have a different meaning than if a two was on the bottom. There's continually development of this understanding of these abstract symbols that represent numbers, but they're building a foundation as you continually develop the language. The language is not just a kindergarten skill. Remember, at that very first slide, I had a picture of kinder with a graduate on the end. I don't know if you noticed, but there were arrows on either side. It's a continual conversation. The senior calculus teacher is not remiss of what the kindergarten teacher has done to develop the foundation for what she is now able to work with. The first grade teacher should not be remiss of the seventh grade pre-algebra teacher in understanding that what she is doing is also helping to build that foundation for when all of a sudden this idea of letters are introduced to represent numbers. Mind-blowing for some. So how does this play out? Well, how do we get from the concrete to the pictorial? Well, as I mentioned, you often start with the cubes. And this is easy. Usually every building has a bucket of cubes of some kind somewhere. My introduction is the idea is that you use these cubes, and what we have in our classrooms is each student has a baggie, and we've sorted them by colors. And within the Cuisinart rods, orange is represented by 10, or I'm sorry, 10 is represented by the orange bar. And so we have a large bag, and each student has their set from 1 to 10 in K1 with the larger snap cubes. And so they have their bag of the continued set of bars. So when a kindergartner is learning their math facts, they first build their bars. Can you put all of the pink cubes in one bar? Can you put all of the brown cubes and connect them to make one bar? And so forth, so that they are building their numbers and understanding their numbers. Can you put your pink bar with your dark green bar and tell me how many do you get? So you've got this introduction of the addition process. But then what I have introduced, and it's, call it a little less professional, but it's my hand drawing page. but we then create and build the process where they literally color in a bar and show where you have, you're probably familiar with the part whole. They color one part pink, the one part green, and when they put it together, they find that it is the same height as the orange. And so they go about coloring their bars on their page as they're building their math facts in the early stages. So this is building that bridge so that when they get to third grade and this idea of a bar is being introduced, it is no longer abstract. They are becoming comfortable with this idea of bars. They are also beginning to associate numbers with not just an abstract item, but also a color. Why is that valuable? Well, I walked into my kindergartner friend's classroom this past spring, and she had her students, and they had one green, one brown, one orange, one of each out on their table. And I said, what are they doing? She said, they're doing their math facts. I said, really? She said, yeah, they already know which color is which number. They only need one color to work with it. They had already memorized and internalized those colors. So then, when you get to the age where Cuisenaire rods truly become useful and beneficial, we're not having to stop and line up and count. They already know what that root digit is represented by which color bar. So it's, for what we have seen, it's developing a bridge that is then abstractly, early on, within a picture image. And we've created these different color sheets that are helping to build and understand their math facts so that when they get to the level of automaticity in their math facts, they are also still relying on that mental process that they now have multiple ways to vision. Whether it's they see three apples or they see the three light green bar, they recognize that there is something behind it, and they've built this understanding to where it becomes an automatic process through the development of their facts. Now, the other thing that much of Singapore math uses is this idea of number bonds. Number bonds are very valuable, especially starting in first grade. And so one of the other handmade, less professional sheets, maybe you might call it, is we partner this coloring bar with the number bonds, and then we cover up different numbers within the bond to where they also begin to see these numbers as fact families. They understand that these three all go together. So if we're missing this set, what's missing? Four. Well, why is four missing? Because that's what makes it complete, because it's a family, it goes together. So whether you have the orange missing, oh, well, this and this, that's your addition fact, or if this is missing, that's your subtraction fact, you see the three numbers as something that goes together. They begin to reach a level of automaticity that is second nature and not something that has to be consumed with the counting level, the concrete. So it's building, the idea is that this is building the bridge from that concrete to the automaticity. The idea that they now have it internalized, not just because of a flashcard, not just because of a favorite pencil time, but they've developed it to where when you do have that timed test coming in, they're working through it quicker. How do we get from the pictorial to the abstract? This is where the Singapore model then is truly a pictorial introduction and not an abstract introduction if they've had a foundation of that bridge already. One of the things that you begin to see this played out is when we get to the level of word problems, to develop the critical thinking, to tell the story, and you develop these ideas of bars. Well, I want to, before we even get to the bars, I want to suggest one thing. If it's truly a language, what's the conversation you're having? If it's truly a language, are you having a conversation about the word problem before the pencil is ever picked up? So the mental process of taking the information and reading it and talking about it and understanding not just the numbers. In fact, I have one teacher who says, I started covering up the numbers, and we just talked about the problem. What do those words within the problem mean? And that way, then when you put in a number, it doesn't matter what the number is, do we first understand what's being considered? One of the things in developing this idea of the bar model is that how do you know how to set it up? Well, if you're having those conversations, again, building the language not just of the numbers but also of the words that are being developed behind them, then it begins to tell the story of what to do. In a moment, I'm going to show you also a list of problem-solving kind of steps that is highly introduced and used a lot in a lot of areas. Now, I'm not as familiar with some of the other resources. Our school uses Math and Focus. But one of the things that I have found is that you've got your word problem, you've got this big space, and then it says the sentence with the blank for you to put in. In a moment, I'm going to tell you why I think that sentence needs to be whited out. So I sum it up for going, yeah, we know that. We've learned that. And what I want to propose is this idea that having the conversation before a number is even written down or before a bar is even drawn is that before you get to that level of where you're creating this, you're first thinking about what is being asked. And that's where I want to kind of look at this idea. Now, some people have published what's called a 6-step problem solving, and some break it down into 7. I'm more of a fan of less is more, but I'll show you when we get to it where the 7th step is kind of thrown in there. So first of all, if you're familiar with the word problems, if you're kind of second grade and up, that's kind of where a lot of the key bar modeling this idea, not that word problems begin in second grade. I'm not saying that at all. In fact, the conversation about story problems and writing your own story problems begin in kindergarten. Sorry. They begin in kindergarten. And this idea of developing the conversation, the story, thinking back to the language, and then developing ultimately to the thinkers, you are having the conversation that's being developed. So you begin with reading the entire problem. Before you can have a conversation about it, you want to read it. And here's why a conversation is important. And this is why I think you should white out that already written statement at the bottom. The next step should be is that they rewrite the question as a statement. If you've ever done kind of keyword outlines, you take a few keywords and then you write the, go back and take your outline and then rewrite it to summarize what you've read. It's the same kind of concept. You are taking what is the key information? Well, the key information is going to come in a word story problem from the question. So what is the question being asked? What are you being asked to find? Write that out. If a student is forced to write it out themselves, then they have been forced to think through what that question is asking. Otherwise, what will most students want to do? Where's the number? Here's the number. Okay, so any kind of key? All right, so I'll add these. That's got to be good. Okay, they're going to look for the numbers first. That's not what they need to look for first. Take those numbers out even. What is it that's being looked for? That's the conversation that builds the critical thinking. All right, next in the story is the who or the what. What is the problem about? You've identified in a statement from the question what is being asked to be found, but what all have they given you within the problem? So who or what is the problem about? And then taking that information to draw a model. Well, most of the resources that I mentioned earlier are going to go to this draw a bar model. Sometimes, depending on the level of learning in 6th and even 7th grade, this strategy is just as good. It's not necessarily a bar model. It could be a diagram that's developing on the coordinate plane for a line. Regardless, you're drawing some sort of image. And at the grammar level with Singapore Math, it is this idea of a bar model. Here's where you'll see this step broken into sometimes 2. As one step, it's you're solving the problem. You've identified it. Now you use the information to then calculate your answer. Sometimes it's broken up into 2 to where you chunk adjust, question doesn't make sense, and then compute your answer. Again, I err to shorter, more succinct steps that they might be able to remember or that might be easier for you to have on space in your room. However, the last step is then to write the answer and check if it makes sense. Well, if you are having these conversations about what the meaning, the why, the how, all along from kindergarten up, then will it make sense should be understood at the appropriate levels. But again, it's having the conversation and using the language within the context of whatever is being looked at. So I want to throw up an example. A farmer has 7 ducks. He has 5 times as many chickens as ducks. How many chickens and ducks does he have altogether? Well, in the same way, we looked at kind of math facts for addition and subtraction being associated here. You can use Cuisenaire rods to also create your multiplication problems. So again, that becomes the foundation to where this all of a sudden is not, well, I've already learned my multiplication facts. I know I'm just going to multiply, so I don't have to do anything else. Why? Well, if you've also early on developed this idea of 5 times 7 can be represented by an array or a set of Cuisenaire rods that you've set up to, again, early on introduce this idea of a bar model, then when you ask them something like this, it's not an abstract idea where they feel like they may be going backwards. Well, how does that work out? What's the second step? I've read the problem. Rewrite the question as a statement. The farmer has how many ducks and chickens? I make sure I identify that it's not just one or the other. It's got to be both. Well, in the problem, I see there's ducks and there's chickens. Now, some resources just have you start drawing bars. Some resources will introduce this idea of a starting line so that everything kind of, you have a starting point. Some of them refer to it as a zero line or a start line. I went ahead and included it on this example here just so you, if it's something you haven't seen before, everyone could see it. So, in the problem, what concrete value am I given that I know for sure? 7. What 7? 7 ducks. I want to make sure I identify the right thing with the right number. So I have 7 ducks. That's what I know. What I don't know that I need to know to get to the ultimate answer, do they tell me how many chickens? Only as how it relates to the ducks. So if that one bar equals the ducks, if I've already introduced the idea of bars having value, then that means I have 5 of those bars. 5 of those bars, and each of those bars represent 7. Now, I'm going to show you 2 things, and I want to encourage you to not say one is right and one is wrong, because one of these is a quality answer and the other one is a quality answer. They're both correct, but they get there in a slightly different way. The first option is where you think about this idea, well, chickens, I've got to find that first. 7 times 5 is 35. I found my chicken. So now, the question mark out on the side, what I'm actually looking for is 35 plus 7, so I have 42. Perfect. But what about the kid who says, I have 6 blocks of 7 up there? And they jump straight to 7 times 6. That is just as right. Don't get so tied to, well, you have to this and have to that. When 7 times 6, there are 7 bars of 7, and there are 6 of those bars represented. That's the child who is taking their knowledge of something that is abstract and building on it and to develop the more building thinking as well, or abstract thinking as well. So I just want to caution you with that. Just because a textbook resource or another resource that you might use says you have to show this and this, recognize that it can also be shown another way, and it is 100% representing the number of bars, the numbers of sections of 7 that are up there. So I just caution you with that, because sometimes if we're uneasy ourselves and if it doesn't look just like that, we've also got to process the information and grow from it as well. So, in the end, the farmer has how many? 42 ducks and chickens. All right. One of the things that I would be remiss is to not mention some of the resources that I have pulled from, some of my inspirations. And I want to go through that, and then I want to take some questions and answers that you might have. But one of the things that I definitely want to do is point out how this developed process of building that bridge can it make a better understanding for the Singapore math students. Or if you're using, say, Envision Math as a resource. It doesn't title it as a Singapore math resource, but it is building on that same bar modeling concept. The first idea is this use of manipulatives, starting from a very early age, kindergarten. We have chosen to match up our Unifix cubes, the larger block snappings for the younger child, the fine motor skills, this is what's perfect for them. I will caution you that not all of them match up the colors exactly. For example, in the Cuisinart rods, four is represented by a four bar, but pink is what we could find. They don't make sets with purple blocks. That's okay. Now, actually, you can find some that have purple, but maybe you find the kind that has the pink. That's okay. It's pink and purple, the same kind of family. You don't want to get too abstract, is my point. But developmentally, a second grader can manipulate and use the smaller gram centimeter cubes. Sometimes they're called an interlocking centimeter cube. I tried to do research on what some of these things were, because if you're not used to having these or where to find them, these are some of the names of how you can find them on in your search. And then the Cuisinart rods. The Cuisinart rods are bars that represent values, specific numbers 1 through 10, and this idea is that you are trying to, again, build that bridge to understand what a pictorial method, but first giving them the concrete foundation before it becomes an abstract idea. Again, I just want to reiterate that this idea is you're wanting to build the bridge sooner. If the first time they're seeing a bar model is at the end of second grade, it's going to become something abstract that you're asking them to do without having the context or a foundation for it. Consider using bars, cubes, not just apples and the teddy bear counters and things like that. Those are all great tools. You want to see them within contexts of different things. But this is helping to bridge that gap to an abstract idea unless they see it sooner. Again, bar models are highly used throughout, even sixth grade. Math and Focus has a middle school textbook series that uses the bar modeling. And so we're not just talking about math facts. The bars begin to represent any value. It's a picture that can represent any value, as the one example that we just showed. The fractions, ratios begin to be represented within bar models. It's everything expanded, but you have to build the bridge early. I would be remiss if I did not let you know where some of my ideas came from, because most of them are not original. My first inspiration was a college professor I had at Sam Houston State University in Huntsville, Texas. And he is probably the one professor and one class I had that even came close to a classical setting. We sat around an administrator's table, call it a Harkness table, and we had our Cuisinart rods in the middle. And we had the produced packets that he gave us on how to explore bar modeling with Cuisinart rods. So 20 plus years ago was when I was first introduced to this idea of having a bar representation for problem solving. And it was that round table discussion, having the conversation of developing the understanding of how these bars represent values and how the bars can be utilized to create a visual representation for a problem-solving technique was first ingrained. So I have to give Dr. Huber credit. Also, shortly after graduation, Greg Tane came onto the market, and he is most famous for his series of books that he has produced, especially for the earlier primary grades. But he also has a fascinating website that has games online. One of the games is incredibly challenging. I actually only just discovered it this spring when it was shared with me by another resource that I was reading up online. And it looks at the idea of, if you have four numbers, 1, 4, 8, 5, which three go together? Now, if you've developed this idea of which bars, which numbers fit, which three go together? 1, 4, 5. So it's a very challenging game, and then they introduce the idea of you're looking at five different values, which three still go together. It's developing an understanding of number, and they have it for both addition and subtraction game and the multiplication game that goes with it. So it's challenging the student to think abstractly once you've developed that kind of concrete image and understanding of how these numbers fit together and work together. I was also at one point in time a homeschooling parent, and I was introduced to C. Demi's Matthew C. And it was not so much the curriculum that open mind went, oh, but what I loved is his set of manipulatives. He had, call it Cuisinart rods with the identified bars, the numbers on it. But the number, the colors didn't match up. But this idea that you had individual bars, not just base 10 blocks, not just your little red flat hundreds, your 10 bar 10 and your single bar 1, but you had a bar that you could count the numbers. That was always my frustration with the Cuisinart rods. Okay, it's 4, but I got to put it up next to this to make sure I'm right. Okay, 7. Oh my gosh, is that 6 or 8? So I got to put it up next to the other one that I do remember. So what I liked about that, and if I didn't give him credit, I would not be being truthful. And so I liked his idea of identifying, and his bars actually are what gave me this idea for using the cubes that they can individually count, but I like that they build it first, especially at that very primary stage. The other resource that I have found useful that goes alongside just having a few more resources of challenging this idea of these fact families going together is the 10 Secrets to Addition and Subtraction Mastery. Otter Creek Institute is the publisher that makes Rocket Math that we utilize at our school, and it is what we find is a phenomenal program, and it is, again, one of the articles that they have tied onto their website about the research behind it is this idea is that first you want to see them developing an understanding of the counting. Their facts have meaning because they've counted them out to begin with. But you also need to get them to the point to where they are deriving those answers, either through a mental picture that they create, or they derive them through a connection of how they know 9 is almost 10, and, well, just one more would make, you know, they're deriving. There's some sort of trick or way that they are visualizing it. And then ultimately it becomes something that is automatic. Finally, there is a book that I found and utilized early on that is called the Singapore Model Method for Learning Mathematics. This is one that's actually produced by the Ministry of Education in Singapore, and so it's kind of at the root of what we see everywhere else, and it has at least one sample bar model problem for pretty much any scenario that you would get into within the grammar stages. But then there are also many other current and modern publishers that have really picked up and done a great job with helping teachers to have a stronger understanding of the ways that the different, more complex bar models are created, especially when you get into this idea of multi-step problems and building ratio foundations and on and on and on and on. And this is, first name is Char Forster. Thank you. And I'm always intrigued by the first name, but definitely has had many of these publishers who have been utilized throughout building this concept. But for me, one of the things that I hope you walk away with today is the idea that the bar model is your friend, but it can also be your enemy if the first time you're introducing it is after they already have an understanding of the concept. If your concept of addition is introduced with their math facts in kindergarten or first grade, then that's where you want to add the idea that there is a model that represents that as well. Otherwise, when you introduce that model at a later stage within the grammar school years, it's now an abstract idea and can become a frustration of feeling like they're working backwards. Thank you. And we do have about 10 minutes if you have a few questions that you'd like to ask about anything. Yes, ma'am. Let me make sure I understand the first part of your question. How do you support this with the parent kind of battle of not wanting to understand? Did I hear that correctly? Yes, they use both. So, for example, we require that math instruction within the lesson of the day be about an hour a day, but that's not your math facts practice. Rocket math should only take maybe 10 minutes at most, and it's often something that's done where you have that weird gap of time. I know when I was teaching fourth grade, I had this odd 15-minute time right after recess, but before we could get to one of our specials. And that was, it just became the 15-minute math facts drill time. We would review, we would practice, and then we would quiz. And it's the rocket math that Otter Creek publishes is it's one of those things that is, they add a few new facts to each page, and they go through sheets A through, it's not always Z, but I'll call it Z, A through Z, and they are developing to where when they get to around level N, M, O, P, Q, those are where you're now in the meat, and then it starts to kind of level back off where they're the meat of, I say, like 7 plus 8 versus 2 plus 3. You know, they're leveling harder and harder facts to it. So that's something different than within the instruction of the lesson. So it's a both combination thing. Okay, gotcha, the spiraling. One of the things that I have encouraged the teachers that we have conversations, sometimes we, our head of school has done a really good job of helping us understand that we set our curriculum. The state doesn't necessarily, the parents don't. We have a curriculum guide, and that is our course. Now, I may get there in a Volvo, I may get there in a minivan, but my course is this path. And so math and focus happens to be one of those objects that we use along that course. So just because math and focus is what we are using, that does not mean that we, that is our only script. So one of the things that we do encourage is that we should be reviewing things along the way, not necessarily from a continued spiral technique, but that so that it's not foreign or it's forgotten. But yes, it is a resource, but it is not our curriculum. And that's what I would also encourage you with whatever curriculum you use. It is a resource. Hopefully you have a curriculum guide that is directing your course, and that course is what guides you. Whatever resources you use along the way is to your benefit of making sure those are the objectives that you have been required to teach. Yes, ma'am.
I have a question. We are actually looking at switching our grammar school curriculum. In our school, all the young children have a teacher for each subject, so they don't have the luxury of having them a couple of times. Mm-hmm.
When we did the switch, we used the shock method. I can't say there's necessarily a wrong or a right. I just have to say that I have heard stories where, say, K-1 and 2 have made their transition first. And then after about a year, sometimes 2 years, then, I mean, obviously you could either add a grade as that group grows on, goes on up, or you could make that K-1 and 2 1 year and then the upper grades the next. I've heard that kind of scenario being done. Sometimes it has to do with what your school can financially accomplish. Sometimes it has to do with how much training you have available to you for not just your teachers, but also for your parents. The comfort level is which your teachers are willing to take it on. That was something we had to consider. But we used the shock method. They did. I mean, there's been some bumps along the way that first year or two because it was just an adjustment period. But in the end, what I am finding when I get my seventh grade students, they are more excited about how what they have learned now has this even newer context with this idea within algebra skills that are being developed. So what I find is I sense that I am getting stronger thinkers when I get to those algebra studies. Yes, ma'am. Yeah.
Okay, you know how to count 1, 2, 10,
right.
And
Right. So the question is really derived in how to develop your pictorial step of learning where you feel that your resources are not providing that from giving the concrete to the abstract and dealing with what can feel like a fast pace to begin with. One of the things that I really encourage you to do is that even though many of the resources that are out there, they will encourage the use of it consistently throughout. The pictorial is meant to be a stepping stone, a bridge to the abstract. So I try to encourage our grammar school teachers that once they have shown that they know how to use it, then maybe it's something that they show and use once, and it's something that they are required to go back and show if they get something wrong. If they say, well, I actually know what that means now. Okay, well, let's see how that works. And if they truly are able to grasp because they first modeled that they know how to get the pictorial. Now, how do you come up with some of those pictorials? That's where you have to be creative and kind of think out of the box. I'm happy you have my contact information within the book. I'm happy to brainstorm with you ideas that I've used or that some of our teachers have used in the past. But that's where you have to tap into your creativity as a teacher as well. I use the concrete and pictorial even in pre-algebra. I mean, it is anytime something new is introduced, you might have the opportunity to revisit this idea of the concrete and develop the pictorial. Within pre-algebra and even geometry, I'm using the idea of the pictorial with a net drawing, with the idea of the different kind of gridded paper to draw three-dimensional objects to understand what I'm looking for before I calculate what the volume is. So it's not something that's left at the early ages. It revisits for new concepts. It's concept-oriented. It's idea to where you're developing thinkers about each new thing that's being introduced. Yes, ma'am?
In grading the model drawing, when we're given a test, if I have, let's say, 15 problems that are just basic math problems, and the other ones are, let's say, I have 5-word problems, and they have to draw up their word model drawing. When I first started doing this, I took off what had it. If they got it wrong, they got it wrong. I started looking more into it and talked with some people, and they said, well, you can allow certain points for certain things, mm-hmm. if they get this right, or if they don't show this, or don't do that. So at what point and with what grade do you decide you need to have all or nothing, or we're going to place more of a value on the part that you're showing versus the answer that you've come up with?
Even at the upper level, I consider partial credit, and here's why. Okay, you're referring to the model drawing. I want to say one thing real quick. Even at an upper level, I'm going to consider partial credit because I want to also grade, are they understanding the process of finding an answer and not just getting that fine answer. But within a model drawing, at what point does it all or nothing? I don't know that it necessarily has to be, because as the development of models change for different kinds of problems, then you're introducing a new understanding of the model. And so it could continue to develop their opportunity to understand when they are, if you see that they understand one concept of it, then that is something to acknowledge. If they make one slip up on one small part and they're not taking the SAT yet, let me put it to you that way. They're not taking the SAT yet. It's not an all or nothing yet. And yes, along the way, they do need to understand that there's an ultimate right answer for the problem. But if showing the representation of it along the way is the part that's stumbling them, then recognize that, again, the child who sees six of those blocks and not five and then another, you have to understand the context within how that student is learning, engaging. Because to make one blanket statement is to put all of your students into one kind of learner, and that wouldn't be fair to them. Yes?
One of the reasons
reasons that our shop method worked was because we did a lot of training. Could you describe some of the training that we did to prepare teachers?
This is my head of school. one of the ways the shock method was effective is because we recognized that it was going to take a lot of training on the front end. And we did spend a fair amount of training that first year going into it, not just at the beginning of the year, but in and out of the classroom. I would go in and spend time with different teachers about different specifics, or I might visit with them after school. This is how this went. And it's I'm not quite grasping, and we problem solve through how to better approach this new idea within their classroom. So there is a lot of training if you do go the shock method route. I'm not saying it can't work, and it has been effective for us, but it does take